It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Michael Bailey. I'm joined here today by the very lovely JJ Ball.
Hello, Michael.
There he is. Hello. And yes. Also John McKenzie. Hello, John.
Hello. Am I not very lovely?
Oh, well, it wasn't deliberate.
Bad start. Yes. Bad start for Michael.
This isn't going as well as the last time I did it already. John, I think you're lovely.
Oh, thanks, mate.
Excellent. Job done.
I don't.
we are swiftly moving on to talk about all of the football. We've got loads of Premier League football like Tottenham, Newcastle, Chelsea, Manchester United, Leeds, Aston Villa, Southampton Forest, and more. I don't think there's many other clubs left. We're also going to drop into Serie A, which is Italian. And we might even look ahead to the Champions League week fixtures, but maybe we won't. We'll see. Bit of mild peril there. You will see lots of writing on all of those subjects if you subscribe to The Athletic. If you haven't subscribed to The Athletic, well, that's okay, because you can do so for free for a 30-day trial. All you need to go to is theathletic.com/TIFO. That is theathletic.com/TIFO. We were going to be joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor today, but we're not, for technical difficulties.
Gremlins, you call them gremlins.
His gates, unfortunately, are not good.
Gremlins stormed the gates.
Literally blamed the gates.
Being held hostage by gremlins.
The gates are locked. Seb is out. We shall carry on without him. Let's get on with the show. Yes, this is us getting on with the show, and we're going to do that by stopping off firstly at Tottenham Hotspur 1-2 Newcastle United. That's how you do the scores, isn't it?
It winds me up no end, but yes, that's how
I feel. I couldn't, you know, not do it like that. Mm.
Almost. Well, Joe is not here, so you can do what you like.
It's in the style guide now.
We have one. Joe really isn't here either, is he? Last time I did this, he was sort of loitering.
Yeah.
Taking care.
He's led the gremlins to storm Seb's gates.
Well, he wasn't sure where he was going to go, was he?
So maybe... He likes goblins and all that Lord of the Rings stuff, so I think he's just embraced the chaos.
I look forward to seeing that play out. Anyway, Tottenham lost at home to Newcastle. Newcastle are good, JJ, which I think you said last week as well. And they scored two goals. How did they score two goals at Tottenham?
Well, I think Newcastle were very good in this game, and Spurs, there's a little bit of a disconnect, not a disconnect, but a bit of unrest between the fans and Antonio Conte. They play in a set way. They knew how Newcastle would play. But I think Newcastle were, like, far and away the better team in this game. Looked really aggressive, really intense, all that sort of stuff we've been talking about. We covered it in TIFO IRL as well recently in a video. First goal's one of those controversial ones where you can say that the goalie, well, it's a referee decision, but it's been decided now. I don't think we should really waste time unless you think... It's never a foul.
No.
I agree.
We're agreed?
No foul.
Play on.
Yes, play on. I don't know what really to talk about this, because we know what Newcastle do, and they do it very well at the moment. A few injury problems that they've sort of got, but they're covering them really well. Like Joe Linton played on the left side as a forward. Now, he's not to try and be a goal scorer. He's there much as a pressing machine to try and win the ball back and stop Spurs getting up that side. I think Bruno Guimaraes this is phenomenal. You see how much he runs that game in this one particularly. But Spurs have a problem because they've changed their shape to like a 3-5-2, and it means they've got less coverage of the front. So the front press is different now. There's lots of space either side of the front two to play around, and Newcastle were playing around that. And they were managing to keep them kind of quiet. The wing backs couldn't push forward as much as they wanted to, and it caused structural issues for Spurs and how they want to pass out from the back. And I think what was interesting about it really at the end was that Antonio Conte was speaking about how, obviously this is bad, and they get beaten by Man United as well, but he says this is the start of the process, and that in his great experience of winning stuff with other teams who have very good players, what he sees in the Spurs team is a team is at the beginning of a process, but he's been there quite a while now. So, but they've signed a lot of players now. So I guess it's the first sort of proper, they spent money this summer. Finally, they got Richarlison and people like that. But they were missing key individuals as well for this. Like Richarlison was missing. Who else was not in this starting lineup?
Kulusevski's out.
And he's like one of the, probably their most important player at the moment. Well, I mean, that's an exaggeration. There's Kane and Son and whatever. But he makes them so much better going forward and in how they press in the front. And without Richarlison and Kulusevski, they then can't play that shape they want to play. So Conte's had to adapt. And that's sort of where we're at. And then Newcastle, great. Yeah, I mean, the Spurs scored their goal from a corner, I think. They're very good at set pieces. That's what they excel at. But they are lacking an intensity that Newcastle have. And Antonio Conte's teams are meant to play with that sort of intensity. So if you sit back and want to hit people on the counter, I think you've got to have a real aggression about you. Otherwise, it starts to look very dull.
Spurs to me seem like they sort of wake up at moments and look very lively. But the rest of it, they're almost incredibly passive. And they're like waiting for something or just not engaged. Which I guess as a supporter, which we'd ask Seb, but Seb's not here. So John, you're the supporter of Tottenham. You know, if you see the team slightly disengaged or waiting for something, then that can sort of affect those who are watching.
Yeah, I think this is a play style issue in many respects. So the thing that Antonio Conte is trying to do is essentially build up deep, draw opposition presses forward, and then generate space around his really elite strike pairing or front three if Kulusevski's playing. And I think what we're starting to see is teams becoming aware of how to deal with that. And there's a number of different ways that you can deal with that. But what I've seen happening a lot against Spurs recently is teams just not engaging with their defenders when they have the ball. So, for example, yesterday, Newcastle were quite happy to let the back three have possession. And they were making sure that the ball wasn't getting into the central midfield areas, and they were trying to slow the build-up down in those sorts of areas. And I think that starts to become an issue. If you can be really aggressive in the midfield areas, you can be quite passive in the first line of the press. You can cause Spurs lots of problems. It happened against Manchester United as well. They did a fairly similar thing, albeit they actually went quite aggressive with their forward line of the press. So they went player for player on the front line and just tried to cause Spurs problems in their build-up in that way, and it worked as well. So it's becoming, I guess, a mantra for teams playing against Spurs. If you can stop them doing their build-up, then you can prevent them from being able to get the ball into those forward spaces onto their dangerous players. And yeah, the big question is going to be, like, how do you deal with that as Antonio Conte? Because it can't just simply be the case that he has to say, well, you know, that's our play style done. He will have to think of different ways of building up, maybe different structures that will allow him to get around these sorts of problems. Maybe even have to rethink about how successful this sort of approach can be in the Premier League.
And their squad as well, because they're trying to then compete. Like, they're third now, right? Before, as we're talking, they're third, yep. I think, yeah.
Chelsea and Man United both have games in hand, which I think would take them ahead. So it's quite close, right?
So then, because the squad's not massive. Like, I think the thing that Conte's talking about with the process is that they're trying to, when they buy players now, they're going to buy players who should be good enough for the first team, which then makes your squad bigger and better because you've got basically rivals for each position, which is something Spurs have not really had. They've had a first team and then backup players who aren't great because it's very hard to sign players. And like a striker to cover for Harry Kane, you're not going to get one because they're going to go, why would I go to you? I'm not going to play because Kane's there. But then you've got Son, Kulusevski, and Richarlison. They're all kind of going for the same positions, bit of competition. That's really good. But when they miss Højbjerg, who's probably the most important player in the middle of the pitch, and Romero, who is what makes them have that aggression and that real character at the back, they're not the same team. Like, teams with small squads, is very obvious. Like, any team losing their best player is going to struggle a little bit. You saw it with Liverpool when Van Dijk was out a couple of seasons ago and people like that, and Fabinho. But with Spurs losing Højbjerg and Romero, it just makes them weaker because they need to have those players. Otherwise, they are just where they were before, a slightly weaker team. And then when Newcastle are pressing them, it's when you start to see the errors creep in, like Eric Dier playing a couple of weak passes, Hugo Lloris maybe not quick enough off his line when the ball goes. So the first goal that Callum Wilson scores was the controversial one, where the ball's put over the top by Fabian Schär. Newcastle know that Spurs are going to push out a little bit, and as they're coming back, Schär hits over the top, Wilson breaks off side trap, and Lloris is maybe out of position, maybe not slow, but out of position, and doesn't rush, just close it down. Then he tries to chest it down, and that's where the goal comes from, because he's not done probably what he should have done there. What's the second goal? It's Almiron scores it, isn't it?
Oh, Miggy. Yeah. Now, there is someone who is just finding a different level. I've moved it on now to Newcastle for Spurs, but it's about Spurs are third. You know, they'll be all right in the context. But Miggy,
Well, the question has been asked of Howard is whether Almiron's the different player of the season because he's more confident. Because when he was signed for MLS for a lot of money, the idea was that he's really quick and really explosive and could do all these sorts of things. And he's been quite medium for ages. Never really done anything in and out of the team. No, it doesn't produce anything. But now, suddenly, when they're playing with that intensity, with a team backing up behind him, he can help with the counter press and with pressing. And he absolutely does in. As it longly goes past, just does him on the outside to then square up onto his left foot to put it past Lloris. I think another poor bit of goalkeeping from Hugo Lloris. We've talked about this before. I think Seb said as well, some of my friends are Spurs fans and they think Hugo Lloris is not up to standard.
Done, maybe.
He's a France captain though, isn't he? He must be.
Well, just, you know, don't get fouled outside your box is a good starting point for any goalkeeper.
Really. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Almiron, I mean, let's be honest, he was ridiculed by his own peers at Manchester City for presumably running very quickly and not producing much end product. So maybe that's had a... effect.
I think whenever you talk about players improving, a lot of the time you have to be aware of the context changing as well, because obviously Miguel Almiron is playing in a much better system than he was previously. He's got a manager who's developed a structure that allows him to do things.
And he's got players that are closer than 40 yards away from him at any given time.
Yeah. Exactly. And this is something that I found interesting thinking about a team like Arsenal, for example, because people are talking about Martinelli has made the leap this season. And I think that Martinelli has improved, but I also think that the structure has allowed him to play in ways that are going to suit his upside. So I'm always sort of a little bit hesitant to say, like, oh, this player just suddenly got better, because it may well be just that the system has got better.
I like that way.
Sorry.
Well, you know, much like Newcastle closing in on Spurs in the table, I suppose is sort of how that conversation's just gone just there. But for context, Newcastle are third, Newcastle are fourth, good start, on 21 points, 12 games played. Spurs are third with 23 from 12. Chelsea and Manchester United do both have a game in hand. So
yeah,
you're all correct. Well done. Taking it back to Tottenham, because that's what Steve has instructed here on the list of questions. Why is Conte not adapting to different teams, JJ? Or is he?
I don't think it's that he's not adapting. It's that he has a system that he likes. He prefers that 3-4-3. I think it's to do with how you can press from the front if you want to press higher. You can't really... like if you have a front two, you mostly use it as a block to show the ball wide. So then you should be able to then put pressure on teams and maybe a more of a mid-block by pushing the wing-backs up so you can get them at a certain point in the pitch. You're basically setting traps with the front two as a block. But it also means, I mean, you want to get your best players on the pitch. You want to get Son and Kane playing. If you want to play a front two and the way you get support with width and the way that Conte wants to play, it doesn't suit a back four. Although he did change during this game to, I think it was a 4-2-3-1 sort of shape, wasn't it, later on in the game, to try and get back into it. So he is sort of adapting, but... I mean, there's an element of whether people know how Spurs play so well now, and if they don't play at the full intensity, if they don't play with all their best players, and they're not good enough to quite break a lot of these teams down. But they are third. Like, they are, okay, the thing is, it's quite boring to watch, because if you're not, I think when you were talking earlier about, like, they don't seem engaged a lot of the time. It's a lot of the time, when you watch a football game and you're a fan, you're like, close them down, go and get that, like, make that stuff happen. When the manager wants you to sit off a bit, because it actually is... it's beneficial to you because it creates space in behind so you can play longer passes for Kane or Son, and then suddenly the wing backs push up, then the rest of the team gets up together and you can do it. Like Newcastle do it all the time. They force the ball into space, they chase it up, it's quite chaotic, but because they then counter press and win it quite high, it looks good. And Newcastle aren't a team who want to dominate possession right now. Well, they keep a lot of possession, but they're not based on positional play and trying to work lovely triangles all the time. It's about a lot of intensity, getting it forward, creating chances through that. Whereas Spurs, I don't know, they have to create somehow because the midfield isn't hugely creative. A lot of the chances will come from wide areas or Kane dropping in to supply for someone else. And if Kane's dropping deep, who's a striker, Son Heung-min, who's not playing, he's not in total red hot form. So that becomes a bit of a problem as well. And they're missing other players. They're all right. That's the thing, they're fine. But like Conte will be looking at this and going, fans are getting a bit fed up with it now. I'm still not competing for the title. I need another 3-4 transfer windows to properly make this a team that could compete for the Champions League or the Premier League, and then you've got to sign the right players, not lose anyone else along the way, and maybe there'll be a job at Juventus coming up soon.
That's exactly what he said. Well, apart from the Juventus bit, but definitely the transfer windows. He did exactly say that.
Why not?
I did bump into Tim Spears on the way in, and he said they'd won their last 10 home games to Tottenham, and yet the atmosphere on Sunday.
Well, these things turn so quickly, right? Because Spurs are all right. It was just a couple of bad results, losing to Man United and the whatever the narrative around them is at the moment. And then Newcastle are a really good team as well, but...
Newcastle are great. We're going to cover that off by just saying they're great.
I think part of the problem with the way that Spurs play in the Premier League is that there are so many really elite teams in the Premier League that when you're trying to encourage oppositions to push forward, the problem is you can get bogged down around your own box. And this is what we saw with Manchester United. Like the Spurs allowed Manchester United to progress the ball forward to the edge of the area. Okay, Manchester United had a lot of very sort of speculative efforts from around the edge of the box. And normally that's fine. But I think the more elite teams have just got better finishers. And so the problem is then is that you're allowing a huge amount of possession to the opposition. And the payoff should be, well, we're generating space that we can try and get in behind. But if they're going to pick up a couple of goals from, you know, the edge of the box, just from you giving them space there, then you've got a lot of work on your hands to try and claw that back. So I wonder whether or not, like, moving from Serie A to the Premier League, there's maybe league effects that are at play here, which I think a lot of people will say, oh, here we go, someone talking about the Premier League being the best league in the world. But the fact of the matter is the talent level in the league is, I think, higher. And there are teams who can cause problems in a way that I don't think Conte's really had to deal with at this level.
They won the league with Chelsea, though. I mean, then he probably turned them around midway through the season. And
yeah, but if you go back and have a look at that season, and look at the teams that they were beating, like, incredible to compare what the Premier League was back then to what it is now. So there's a run of games where he's playing like West Brom, Swansea, Stoke, Burnley, like lots and lots of, I mean, they're a bad team. 2015, I think.
Was it?
2015? Yeah. Norwich right in the Premier around League. they've beaten them. I blame the automatisms, but that's for another day. And someone else. Speaking of Manchester United and Antonio Conte's former clubs, were we doing that? I think we were. Chelsea 1-1, Manchester United was the scoreline at Stamford Bridge. Now, this was quite a slow burner, maybe. But anyway, Graham Potter did make a tactical change after about 35 minutes, quite precise. What was that and why did it make a difference, John?
Yeah, so Graham Potter put Chelsea out in the regular sort of 3-4-3-ish formation that he likes to do. And it very quickly became obvious that it wasn't working. Manchester United were able to, I think, dominate in a couple of phases. They were able to build up quite comfortably for various reasons. So they had Chelsea had two midfielders because they were playing a 3-4-3. And what they were trying to do is they were trying to match up against Manchester United's three midfielders by doing what I like to call hybrid pressing. So that's when you basically bring in other players to cover in that central midfield area in certain phases of play. And the idea is that you're supposed to move comfortably when the ball changes into a different phase. You can sort things out so that there's never a free midfielder. The problem is it can be quite complicated to do. And so what was happening is that Manchester United, particularly Eriksen, was finding a bit of space, and Manchester United were able to just progress the ball forward quite comfortably. The other thing that was happening was that Manchester United were pressing player for player against Chelsea's back line, essentially. They had a front three against Chelsea's back three, and then the rest of the players were matching up one to one across the front lines pretty much. And it was causing Chelsea a degree of problems. I mean, Chelsea did break the press, I think, the first line of pressure, and we're getting the ball to Azpilicueta, but then it was breaking down around there. So basically, Graham Potter just changed his formation so that both of those issues went away. He took out one of the centre-backs, took off Cucurella around the 35th, 36th minute, brought in Kovacic and moved Kovacic into the centre, so they had an extra player in midfield, and it meant that they were then playing with a back four. So Manchester United's front three didn't really match up as well. So it was easier to build up for Chelsea from the back because they were able to have overloads in certain areas. And also they weren't giving Manchester United the sort of space that they had in midfield. So yeah, you said a slow burner, it was, but tactically fairly interesting game, I think.
He's good, isn't he, Graham Potter? Like, I mean, that is him affecting a game. You know, he's still early in his reign, but he's settling in, and he looks like comfortable, confident, good at his job. All those things we don't always see in managers.
Hey? Yeah, it seems to be. It's going very well for him just now. I mean, the other side of that coin, if you've been really sceptical, you could say, well, he should have got it right from the start. He should be able to know what Man United would do. But
good point.
I think affecting the games like that is really, obviously, that's very important to do with it. But John's covered Chelsea quite a lot on Tifo IRL. You can see it on YouTube, and done a lot of the stuff that Potter's already influenced at Chelsea. And I think one of the signs that he's a good coach is that you can clearly see differences in what Potter's Chelsea are doing now to what the other chap, Tuchel,
was doing before. Gone, Thomas. Already forgotten, poor Thomas.
Yeah, he's just gone. Oh, no.
I wonder what he's doing now. Anyone know what he's doing now?
He was spotted in India recently.
Oh, that's where I'd go. I wonder where.
I think I know.
Well, we'll keep waiting until you tell us.
Maybe I don't know.
Sorry. No, Steve, you need to literally leave and go and find out where Thomas Tuchel in India is in India, please. JJ, what were you saying before?
Well, in this game, we saw a right-footed shot or touch from Antony, which is, I think,
listening to you.
The first time I've seen him use his right foot, and I'm not trying to exaggerate for comedy. I really think he just doesn't use it. It was a bit of a problem, it looked like, a few weeks ago when he would drive up the right wing, and then the way you would get the ball into the box because of the way you're running has to be right foot, curl it in, but he just cannot do it. So he'd use it outside of his left foot while running, which is crazy. It's a crazy technique. It doesn't work. You can obviously do that. I can't remember the word for it. What is it when you play the ball at the outside of your boot? There's a word for it. They use it in Pro Evo.
Travella.
Travella, yeah. Ooh. Something like that, or Travella, maybe. I don't know.
Probably.
Travago.
That's not the Spanish I learned in the north.
Anyway.
England.
I call it Swaz.
Carry on. Yeah, that works. Charisma used to do it a lot, wouldn't it? Yeah. So he's trying to do that. Sometimes it's okay, but he has to cut back all the time, and that slows it down. As soon as you cut back, you allow teams a couple of seconds to get back in shape, and the chance is often gone. But you can see it. He gets in behind. Kepa's slightly too far to the left positioned. He's got most of the goal to aim at. I think he should have been able to score in that big open space, but he bends it wide right with his right foot. So at least he's trying with the right foot, and they'll maybe see him developing. But the thing is, if you're like, how old is Antony? He's like 22 or something like that. Because you gather your technique, and you're pretty much the technical finished player by the time you're about 18. The other stuff that comes with game management and learning to read situations, that's the experience that makes players better. But can you suddenly learn to use your right foot?
He's got all week,
He's a brilliant player on his left foot, this thing.
It's loads of training time.
I'm not trying to say he's not a good player. I think he's amazing, Antony. Like, I like watching him at Ajax. He's great in the Champions League. It's just that's so odd to be so one-footed at that level. That even like lots of left-foot players have been very one-footed and just lean into that, but he's very much...
Especially from a wide area as well. Like, yeah. If a defender is coming up against him, they know that to show him down the right, it probably makes their task a little bit easier. But I do think Antony's sort of good enough on the ball to be able to cut inside and do it anyway, right?
I mean,
that was the thing
with
Robin,
yeah.
Wasn't it? Like, Robin was very one-footed, but he... And the joke was always, like, you know exactly what he's going to do, and he does it anyway. So I guess he just has to become very adept at doing that.
I mean, like, even, like, Riyad Mahrez is quite one-footed, but he can use his right an awful lot as well. But I mean, he's not one-footed. He's far more ambidextrous. Is that what you're
putting? Ambifootstrous, I believe.
Yes.
I mean, the longer this conversation goes on, the harder it's going to be to resist mentioning Wes Houlihan. So let's...
Wes,
thank you, John.
Yeah. I'm a massive fan of Wes.
Oh, obviously, because you've seen him
play. Let's talk about Wes Houlihan.
Oh, wow. Don't tempt me, John. Let's move on. We didn't get to talk about Graham Potter looking good. Let's not talk about that because he just does look good. It's absolutely fine. But we probably should... You know, United are... It's coming together, isn't it? There's elements there where... I mean, let's be honest, it looked like a bit of a... Bit of a wreck at the start of the season, and it's much more coherent.
Manchester United are really interesting, I think, because...
Yes. Good start.
The thing that you have to remember with Manchester United is that they are set up to play in a certain way, but they want to play in a different way. And so they have a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde approach to a lot of games, right? So some games they can come out and play really transitional football where they're sitting a little bit deeper, they're looking to not concede, and then so they've beaten... certain teams doing that, right? They've beaten Arsenal by playing in that way. They've beaten Liverpool. Liverpool? Did they beat Liverpool? They beat someone else playing that way.
They did beat Liverpool.
But they also want to be able to beat the smaller teams. And you can't, as Manchester United, you can't sit deep and try and counter against smaller teams because they're not going to try and possess the ball. So what we're seeing is Ten Hag trying to get them to a situation where they can do this more possessional football like you would expect more elite sides to be able to do. And so at the moment, like there's some games where Manchester United are looking good and there's other games where they're not looking as good. And the big question is, like, what's the difference between them? And I think the difference is just being able to code switch between those two different ways of playing. And the last couple of games, I think, have been really promising for Manchester United because they've come up against teams where they've been able to maybe play in the more progressive way that they might want to in future. But there's still a lot of work to be done. So I mentioned the Spurs game. Manchester United were good in that game, but I feel as though Spurs did very little to stop Manchester United from building up. And I think we've seen teams this season cause them problems in build-up phases. So the Brentford game, for example, is one where Brentford were quite aggressive in their pressing and it caused Manchester United problems and they actually lost the game on that basis. So I think that the Spurs game, for example, they were able to progress the ball to the edge of the penalty area. And then the big question is, like, how are you generating chances? And that, I think, has been true of a number of games. I mean, Manchester United did the same against Ammonia in the Europa League, where they were able to progress the ball quite well. But when it came to like the final third, it was maybe they were maybe struggling at least in the first half to generate any sorts of good chances. So that's where I'm at with Manchester United now. It's sort of, if you can cause them problems in certain areas. So, for example, like if you can stop them from building up, like how good are they? And then once you get to the final third, like how good are they at generating those really good, repeatable chances that will mark them out as being a very good side? But the same is true of Chelsea, it's worth saying. Like Chelsea under Tuchel, the big question was like, okay, they can progress the ball forward well, but once they get into the final third, they're just not dangerous enough. And I think there's still questions to be asked of whether or not Graham Potter can overcome those problems too.
Well, there was a bit, I think Laurie Whitwell wrote in The Athletic.
Theathletic.com /Tifo.
Today, what do you say? How one of the things that Ten Hag wants to do is for his team to create from midfield. So not from deep, not relying on that counter-attack, but that sort of long ball. Basically, like I remember talking to a couple of managers in the past and asked them about their style of play, what they wanted to do. And what they've said is why are your defenders shelling it over the top to no one? It looks like you can't be what you want them to do. And they said, I get this all the time. Well, it's like, it's not that. You need to look for where the space is. Where is the space? Often it's behind a backline. Often it's wide. So you put the ball in the space. You can gain territory. It's like rugby. Push up, chase it. Newcastle do this. Oh. And chase it up and you can get the ball. You can pin a team into a certain area and you build from a higher position. Like United right now, what I saw against Newcastle was they really struggled to play out from the back. I don't know if it's players just not quite sure where everyone is supposed to be at certain times. Players like, I think, Diogo Dalo seems like a decent player, but his passing, if you watch, sometimes the angle is just slightly off and it really causes issues for other teammates. Like, it'll be recorded as a successful pass, but sometimes his passing is a little bit loose, things like that. You can get little players making mistakes, especially under pressure, and that's one of the problems where they got kind of building out from the back. But we saw against Spurs, some of that positional rotation, especially in the midfield, was really working, and they were able to press higher up, especially without having Ronaldo in the team. Mm. Like, that's one of the reasons
I think they were doing so well.
One of the reasons they were so good against Spurs, genuinely, is because Ronaldo wasn't in the team, so they could press from the front in the way they want to. And it's not a relentless, intense press, but they can cover certain angles. The goalkeeper gets closed down when he needs to. Last time I saw Ronaldo play, he was letting the goalkeeper have the ball for as long as he wanted to against Newcastle, I think it was.
But then he scored. And then it was disallowed.
Yeah, but it doesn't. I mean, you score one goal, but your team concedes two. Like, there's huge numbers that show the amount of games they win without and win with. It's like when you play a five-a-side and you've got a guy who scores you like five goals a game. He's amazing. He's all dribbles. He's so good. But your team still loses because all he does is stays in the corner at the top of the pitch. It happens all the time. So you need a bit. It's all about the team. And I think Ten Hag's really got this. And it, like, part of management isn't just the tactics or, you know, that sort of stuff. It's about managing the dressing room and the club and like your role within it. And the way he's managing Ronaldo now is very difficult to do because Ronaldo was a big deal and Ten Hag isn't quite just yet. So that's quite complicated, especially when you've then got loads of people in the media, like the pundits who would then side with other things. Anyway, build up to one thing.
Oh, yes. Carry on.
Creating chances in the midfield is another thing. You can see it's a work in progress and I can see that they are getting better, but it depends on who they're playing against. Like Spurs press with the front two, so it's not the same. Chelsea, what was their pressing structure? Was it
Chelsea were quite passive actually in the first phase as well. They were doing the thing that they did against Milan, which is they have a front three, but their forward is on the pivot player rather than on the back.
To encourage them out a bit?
Yeah, so you allow them the ball and say, we're not going to give you any space in midfield, but because we don't think you're going to be dangerous enough from the back line to cause us problems. So,
I mean, I'm still thinking about the five-a-side team where you don't enjoy it because one player is just going off and doing their own thing all the time. But there we go. I like to tie everything up, obviously, with no loose ends. So Chelsea won the Premier League title in 2017, I think it was. Who finished second that year? That
was Norwich.
Conte? No,
I think it was Norwich, yeah.
Norwich might have been seventh. It was Spurs. So there we go. That's exciting. And also, Steve has returned from his investigations. He says, after an extensive trawl of social media, apparently Thomas Tuchel appears to be in the southwest of India, in the Kerala region.
I was going
to
say that.
Oh, you should have done that, John. The state fruit of Kerala is the jackfruit, a tree in the fig and mulberry family. It tastes sweet. Basically, imagine a massive fig. There you go. I've had jackfruit. It's lovely. It's really good. Really good meat substitute. Jackfruit.
Yeah, that's true.
There
yeah.
you go. And I've been to Kerala, which is lovely. No one cares, but I'm just sharing that information.
I care. I
thanks,
care.
John.
It's just nice not being bullied by Jay, you know, so I'd like to make the host feel well.
If only I had called you lovely at the start. right, more football after what this is, which is going to be a break.
Yes.
Hello, it's Kate Borsay, Lindsay Hooper and Hayley McQueen here, otherwise known as The Offside Rule.
We have a very special show. It's been 10 years of The Offside Rule. If you've been enjoying it over the last decade, you can get some extra insight.
Yes, we have a really good chat about how the industry has changed in the 10 years and chat as well about some of the highs of recording a podcast as an only female trio in the football world and some of the lows as well. So join us for fun.
We're also joined by Harriet Drudge and Laura Williamson from The Athletic. So check it out. That's The Offside Rule.
That was the break. We're just carrying on. So we're going to carry on into this match, which is Leeds United 2-3 Fulham. Where, speaking of managers who are massively, this isn't going very well, whose fans love them. That was supposed to be a joke, but it doesn't work because I paused on it. Anyway, Jesse Marsh is still Leeds manager.
I believe so.
But this wasn't very good, was it? Losing to a newly promoted team at home. I don't know what that's like. That sounds great.
I mean, we lose to everyone these days, so they're not special.
You're not special anymore.
Yeah.
Poor Leeds.
Yeah, poor Leeds. And it's funny, isn't it? The high was very swiftly followed by the low. So beating Chelsea 3-0 has been followed by a very poor...
Oh gosh, yes, that happened, didn't
it? Very poor run of form where there's been no win since.
So how do you go from being that good to that bad? And why does no one like Jesse Marsh?
Well, I mean...
I should just say, by the way, I was at Bramall Lane on Saturday covering Sheffield United 2-2 Norwich City. What a triumph of Championship football that was. And, you know, there's a few people who are obviously, you know, nearby in Yorkshire, and they were Leeds fans. And they were, you know, talking about Jesse in reasonably derogatory fashion. It's, you know, likening him to other American characters and, you know, time to go. And that was before they'd lost, I think.
There's definitely a little bit of xenophobia with American managers coming in because they just don't sound right for the... Like, I think a lot of people don't like managers because the way they look, they don't look like football managers. I think that really happens.
Oh, what does a football manager look like, JJ?
I think in England, it's someone who looks very British.
Excellent.
Well, I don't mean everyone. I mean there's certain people. There's definitely... I'm not saying this is actually what people think, but I think subconsciously there's a certain thing in certain elements of certain media and in fans who will want someone who looks like the way they think they should look or who sounds like the way they should sound. And Americans, they call it soccer, that sort of thing.
They do, yes.
Because Jesse Marsh, he's a great manager, John, isn't he?
Cool, that's a good question.
I mean...
Quicker, John, quicker.
It depends what you like, I guess. But there is this joke about me not liking Jesse Marsh, but very much my issue is with the play style that Leeds have. And interestingly, if you look at the games we've played well in this season, two of them have come against Chelsea and Arsenal, who are top six sides, if not top four sides this season, which doesn't seem to make much sense. And then you watch them against sides that we should be beating, as you mentioned, like a newly promoted side. We struggled against... teams that were, I mean, Aston Villa were at rock bottom when they played against us, and we were lucky to come away with a point from that one. And yeah, so much of this just comes down to the play style. So the issue with the Red Bull style of play that Jesse Marsh uses is that the focus is not on possessing the ball so much. The focus is on being able to generate dangerous chances through counter-pressing. Largely. So you don't, the idea being you don't need to hold the ball, get it into those dangerous areas from the back. What you do is you move the ball into dangerous areas. Either you go direct and try and score, or you wait for the ball to break down, win the ball back quickly, and then hope to exploit the chaos that ensues.
Well, that should be fun to watch. That should be really fun.
Yeah. In theory, I suppose it is. And that's why when you play against teams like Chelsea and it works out, the fans are excited about it. But then when you come up against teams who refuse to actually try and build up in those kind of areas where you're going to press the ball back, it just becomes very sludgy very quickly. So
is it more fun to watch than when a team like, say, Spurs are really sitting deep and not being engaged?
I suppose it depends what you enjoy about football, right? This is what we're talking about, though, right? It's the aesthetics.
That's the noise. Aesthetics. I don't know what
aesthetics. Yeah.
Okay.
We all know what I mean.
We do.
It's a lot to do about with what the perceived way of the club is. I think there's some pun. I can't remember who said it. They're talking about this is not really the Tottenham way. It's like, what is the Tottenham way though? I'm not sure what that is. And there's always the West Ham way. I've never been sure exactly what that is.
The Spurs is what's the line? Football is about glory, right? So the Spurs approach is supposed to be really flamboyant football. Right. If you lose at the end, you're like, oh well, at least it was glorious. So I guess that's not what's happening.
Is that glory?
They seem to like the Pochettino era. Lots of Spurs fans, so like a lot of people really like that. But they were successful during that period, and I wonder whether, because I saw them a few times live, and I'd never thought they were that entertaining, but lots of people have told me that otherwise. I just saw some stuff, the other games I haven't seen where they were really good to watch, but it seemed like a bit of a mid block and things like that. But Leeds, whenever I've seen them, it seems quite chaotic, and therefore I might be able to invest myself more into that.
I think it's definitely entertaining if you're a neutral. I think when you're watching it as a fan, it very quickly gets old, especially because the high points of playing against a team are trying to build up against you and you're causing them problems, and it's an Arsenal or a Chelsea, and you can be like, look, we're holding our own against a big team. That's fine. But no one else is trying to do that. Everyone else, I mean, even so, Crystal Palace tried to do that a little bit in the first half against us, and they were lucky to go in at 1-1 at half time. But in the second half, they sort of dominated us by being a little bit more direct, playing over our press and getting the ball into dangerous areas where they could cause problems, and we ended up losing that game. So it's frustrating as a fan, because you want to, I think when you're a team like Leeds in the situation that we're in, which is we just come from a season where we nearly went down, you want to feel as though you can beat the teams around you rather than cause problems for the teams who you're happy to, like the free hit games, right?
I feel this is an issue with Leeds, isn't it? That, you know, they finished 13th, I think, 2 years ago, and they had, you know, Rafinha and
they finished
Kelvin.
Ninth.
Phillips, was it ninth? Even better.
Was it ninth, as though the difference between 13th and ninth isn't glorious. You need to watch some Spurs, mate.
Football is glory. Football is ninth. Leeds. They did that with Kelvin Phillips and Rafinha, and then Phillips didn't play a lot last year because he was injured, and now he's sold, and then Rafinha is sold this summer, and the players they brought in are sort of for the style that Jesse Marsh wants, but are they actually any better? So why would they then suddenly improve? Why would they not regress by taking the better players out of the team and away you go?
Yeah, it's a play style thing. So the big question is, can this play style succeed in the Premier League? And my gut feeling on this has always been no, because there's two different things. On the one hand, like the teams that you're trying to press against usually are gonna be good enough to beat you anyway. So Arsenal beat us. We played better than them and they beat us. There are also teams who are just going to be able to play through the press anyway and not be bothered by it. At the other end, I think, and I mentioned this before, the Premier League is such a moneyed league that teams just don't want to get knocked out of the league, because then you lose a lot of revenue, right? So I think at the bottom of the Premier League, teams are just happy to sit in and get a draw. And that is causing problems to Leeds at the moment, because those teams are refusing to engage in that kind of counter-press or allow that kind of counter-press. They're just going long over the press into the space behind. And if you're playing that kind of aggressive counter-press, you have to push everyone up the field. You create space in behind. It's also very ball dependent, right? So if the ball's on one side, all of your players are on one side, so you create space on the other, and that can be exploited as well, and that's what's killing us right now.
Is there not Simples. To do with like chance creation as well? So the way I see Leeds is that a lot of the play, they try and force play through the middle. So I always think that I kind of agree with that. Your best chances are if you can create through the middle, and like City use their wide players mostly as a diversion or to create width in the middle for wide players. That's what they do. They don't really score from crosses out wide. It's through the middle. So if you just maximize your chances of putting through the middle, you do that. Jurgen Klopp's theory is that better than having a number 10 or some sort of playmaker in midfield, you create chances through creating chaos. So there's turnovers, people are not in their correct defensive shape, and that's who you create. So if Leeds have a weaker team and squad than other players, having a defined play style for me kind of makes sense when you want to do what he's doing. But the problem is, obviously, when it doesn't work, then to play that kind of style, you need to be really intense, aggressive, and probably confident that it's going to work to make it work. And when you don't have those ingredients, then the thing sort of falls down. Like he said that after the game, that everyone at the club's aligned, the board, staff, players. I mean, he probably would say that, but
united. Yeah. Everyone's united. Although he didn't mention the supporters.
At Leeds United. Yeah. Yeah. Well, did he? I don't think he said supporters. He said. No. He said. Yeah.
I think he would be a bold man to suggest that the fans are behind him. Right now. I agree with you. I think part of the problem again is that when you're playing that style where you're going to go really direct and you want the ball to sort of fall out in those central areas, what you want is space for the opposition to have to then defend backwards, so they're running back towards their goal. And I think a lot of teams now against us will sit a little bit deeper, and they can just step forward into those more direct attacks, and just don't think it causes as much problems in that way as well. I suppose the big question then is that if your whole play style is built around counter-pressing and teams aren't going to let you do that, then what's left?
Yes, Jesse, figure it out. Nice to hear you say us there, John. Jesse Marsh has 11 losses from his 23 Premier League games in charge.
Six wins, I think, is the six interesting wins. Bit there. Six wins from 23
six
games.
Six wins out of 23. Yes, I've failed to pick the interesting bit. Right. Still, 11 defeats is a lot. But you are right.
Lots of goals against. 23 yeah. games, 37 against. So 26-4, that points to it and maybe not working the way you want, right?
Yes. Yeah. Agreed. Fulham, if we were talking about aesthetics, should we talk about Fulham? Do they have an aesthetic? They're seventh. And they seem to be playing nice stuff. That seems to be that's Steve's bold claim there. They're playing nice stuff. They do have an experienced team and the manager knows what he's doing at this level. They'll be fine, won't they? Let's just say it. They'll be fine. They're going down. You're fine. Good luck to you, Fulham.
Yeah, I think when you're a team like Fulham, when you come up, you just need to sort of be solid, right, in your first season. Make sure you've got decent structure. I think Marco Silva's a fine manager. I'm just looking at the underlying numbers now, so I have a feeling that maybe they maybe are overperforming slightly. Yeah, they're in the bottom three according to expected goal difference. But by expected goal difference, Leeds are mid-table, so... What do the expected numbers actually know?
Well, I'm going to reel myself in then.
None of this matters.
Maybe Leeds won't be... maybe Fulham won't be fine. Maybe Leeds will be fine. All will be revealed in the coming months. Right, well, that's those ones. That's exciting. One team that did sack their manager was Aston Villa. Aston Villa 4-0 Brentford. What do we think Steven Gerrard was doing at the weekend? When this result came through, JJ, where did you imagine Stevie G being?
Liverpool. Yeah. He's always Liverpool. When he was at Rangers, he was always in Liverpool.
Hmm. Like a nice bar. Cafe.
I don't know. Cafe bar. Just probably at home with his family, to be honest. I mean, that's
a nice idea. Yeah.
I guess that's what he does.
That's nice.
But he's in a pub with Graham Souness.
Reacting to this result?
Yeah.
Watching Soccer Saturday. Anyway, yes?
Well, Steven Gerrard had a very defined style of play at Rangers, which was informed almost entirely by Michael Beale, who was doing very well at QPR and just turned the Wolves' job down. Michael Beale...
and the Villa job, wasn't it?
Yeah, he turned the Villa job down as well. Michael Beale knows his... He kens his tatties, which means he knows his potatoes. And he is doing very well at QPR. But waiting for his time to kind of shine. Gerrard has the star appeal, attracts players. Obviously, people want to play with him. They want to be coached by him because he's one of the best players the Premier League's ever had. One of the best players in Europe, like of his generation, certainly. But his team at Aston Villa, I mean, it's a hard job to take on because the expectations are so high and they're kind of limited to what they did. They spent a lot of money on players. The key ones that they've signed are not available. They're injured, so that's a real problem. Like Diego Carlos, that was a big signing. Defender is going to make them much better, much more reliable, to basically replace Tyrone Mings in the lineup. Mings has made about two mistakes in the last 3 weeks that have cost them goals. And you see, that's the kind of thing that might make a big difference. So maybe if he just like force quit the game and started again, he might be able to get better results and they'd be better up the table.
Is that Football Manager reference?
I was thinking I might start with the Aston Villa game this season. Yeah, I've got the beta for Football Manager. Anyway, but here, so the shape he plays or the structure is always a 4-3-2-1. So like teams tend to... The trend or like just what everyone kind of does is whatever shape you play, you end up in something like 2-3-5 or a 3-2-5 in your attacking shape. That's what you end up. And it's all to do with where do you want to win the ball back? Where do you want to create from? Where do you think the most valuable places to score are from, and what players do you have? What can you do with them? Gerrard has an all right team. Like that's a mid-table team, I'd say, he's got at Aston Villa. But he was playing them in that 4-3-2-1 with two narrow players behind the striker. They're meant to go wide, and then they rely on all the width coming from the fullbacks. Same thing did at Rangers. It's one of the reasons at Rangers you had Barisic has provided more assists than any human has ever done, and James Tavernier was top scorer by about 80 goals, because they were always feeding each other from crosses to deep the back post, relying on the width from those players there and any other players at the top that were working around. Then you've got your three that protect the two behind them. The two very much the central defenders, don't have to be able to do too much special with it, and the three would work to win the ball back and keep them up the pitch. And it's kind of, this Villa team is boring to watch. I think it's really boring. You did a thing for us,
right? I did do a thing, and I pretty much said that for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
But in Venice, Aaron Danks comes in, he gets 2 days, changes the formation, and boom, it's everything's fine.
A simple, like, basic previous meta FM formation of a 4-2-3-1. You play the two wide players wide, and you've got Leon Bailey, great winger, you play him wide, you can come inside his right foot. You play Buendia through the middle, who's
that's the one.
A great player. Coutinho's just not in the team.
Like just Buendia. Do that. I like yeah. Buendia as
just
well,
just done
mate.
That, Stevie.
Yeah.
Carry on.
And then Watkins plays wide right, but you can get in the middle because then you get Matty Cash overlapping. Just very basic things they've done here. Did not expect a 4-0 against Brentford. I mean, but
dare I say, Stevie probably was hoping to play Brentford at home. I don't know. For a new manager, not a new manager bounce, but you know, a managerless side, that's a decent fixture.
I mean, so much of it is accidental and luck, and you need things to go your way sometimes. But what it often seemed under Gerrard was that, maybe you agree with the research you did for this, was that he depends on individuals to create things for him rather than the system creating things itself. So he gives his players a bit of a cushion to allow for turnover and stuff like that, but he tries to keep it quite quiet. And he would often have only four players in the attacking third. When he played the diamond with two up top, like playing that one quite a lot as well, they didn't really create anything that was that fantastic. It was very rigid, not an awful lot of movement, just relying on big players to create things. And I'm not saying this is at all what Gerrard is doing, but I mean, he was an amazing player. And it's not always that those players are able to get across the things that they instinctively did that made them so good. And then if you try and coach from the training ground, you can make them form their own solutions to certain situations. But when it comes to the actual games, if you don't have the players of the likes of Liverpool and Man City, then those things don't happen. Those individual bits of magic don't happen. So that Real Madrid won the Champions League playing a very, what's the word? Not diplomatic. What's the word when you...
Dogmatic?
No. Pragmatic.
Pragmatic
approach.
That was right. Forward from the start.
Got amazing players. Yeah. Nemanja Matic. And they play all... They don't have to have all the ball, but they win with moments of absolute magic from individual players that are relying on. And Gerrard often says, oh, I need more from these individuals. You need them to step up and deliver. But if they're not being given the platform to score those things, it just falls apart. And the Villa fans clearly lost their connection with him at some point along the way.
Was there Steve sneezing in the middle of there? I hope that audio came through. All right. Expect that rate of improvement to continue for Villa. It's the only logical assumption.
8-0 next week.
Yeah, well, maybe just one goal at a time. Okay. Leon Bailey was absolutely delighted. Listening to him after the game, he's like, expect big things now. We've got loads of freedom. Off we go. So there you go, Leon. Do that. Right. Let's have another break. That was another break. Oh, Southampton 1-1 Arsenal. Okay, we're going to talk about Arsenal. So Southampton first. That's exciting. Although I do just want to say that the idea is that Arsenal have got so many points now that Newcastle in 96 are the only team that haven't won the Premier League from their position of however many points they have. They are on a hiding to nothing from now on, Arsenal. And here they drop 2 points. So that's the start of that. We should talk about Southampton because Ralf Hasenhüttl made a change. Tactical change to, yeah. After they went a goal down and, you know, possibly could have been more down. And then they sort of claimed a point by creeping back into the game. I mean, it was still not very, like, exciting. Am I allowed to say that? I don't know. John, talk.
Yeah, I watched this one with my flatmate, Henry.
Oh, hey, Henry.
He said
did he enjoy it?
He said it was the most boring game he's seen this season Arsenal. So he's an Arsenal fan. So, yeah, that I guess that by way of context. But in terms of, like, the Hasenhüttl formation change, yes, I think that they went from a 4-4-2 to, like, a 3-5-2, just went a little bit more solid at the back. And I think they needed to. In the first half, they were pretty open and Arsenal had a few chances to actually finish the game off. But in the second half, actually, I thought that what happened was that the issue was more with Arsenal. This is something Arsenal obviously are sort of like prototype Man City style team, right? They want to play positional play. They want to dominate the ball. They want to generate dangerous moments through exploitation of space, whatever. But they seem to have an issue like later on in games in terms of game management. So I made a video on Arsenal this week, and I pointed out that Arsenal, I think, in all competitions this season, they've not conceded a goal in the first 30 minutes, and they've scored 10. In this game, they obviously scored in the first 30 minutes and didn't concede in the first 30 minutes. So that trend continues. So Arsenal going into games with what we call a favourable game state. So they're in control of the game. They're a goal up and they have to sort of see games out. And it's transpired that in a lot of games, I think in the second half, Arsenal have looked a lot less assured of where they're at. So there was a lot of people who had watched the Leeds game where Arsenal had been okay in the first half and then really fell off in the second half. And the big question is, like, why is this happening? Why are Arsenal going from a position where in the first half they're dominating the game and then in the second half letting oppositions back in? And I don't necessarily have a good answer for that. But one of the things that I think, to go back to Manchester City, the allusion that I made there. Now, one of the things that Manchester City do is that they dominate possession and they force teams back into their own box. Now, sometimes they get hit on a counter and can concede that way, but they're always going to be pushing teams back. Whereas with Arsenal, it feels to me that they're not as aggressive, they're not as brave at forcing teams back in those moments. So they want to retain possession, but rather than retaining possession in the opposition half, they're doing it a lot more in their own half. And this is allowing opposition teams to just step forward a little bit more, try and win the ball back in those moments, but also it just means that they're out of their own half for longer stretches, and so it just invites more chances for the opposition as well. So I think this is something that Arteta is going to have to work on, and it's happening a fair bit this season. So that was the interesting thing for me about this game, like how much of this is to do with Arsenal not having the bravery to possess the ball in higher areas where you're going to be under more pressure and you're inviting the possibility of a goal on the break versus actually trying to hold the ball at the back and then allowing oppositions to press you a little bit more and then losing the ball and then generating chances in that way.
I saw it as well a lot with Southampton kept them quiet, as in they find it hard to get into midfield in the first place. So they sat a bit deeper off them. I can't remember if they were pressing high from the start and then falling back, but I thought Arsenal were really finding it difficult to get into the midfield and keep the ball there, because the way Southampton were setting up was designed to block the middle of the pitch and have players wide, so they couldn't get through those areas. And then when Arsenal get into that other half, whereas Man City might then play with the tempo and slow it down, get everyone in position so they can then control it, Arsenal would see that as a chance to attack, which makes sense, because that's when you've got a bit of space. If you can get past the press, you've got space to attack. So it's working as well this season. But that's where the difference between control, and you might see some Man City games, they look a bit boring when they're just playing it about. It's all purposeful to control the actual game. But like, yeah, I agree with the first half bit. Second half, I was on a train at the time, so I couldn't see all of this. But I remember what I saw is that Southampton get them really quiet. They struggle to create. And then Arsenal naturally having play very intensive football all season long. They had a game on Thursday, so they had a day less to prepare and recover and rest. Naturally lost intensity later on in the game. And so when you lose that and you're basing a lot of where you're playing around being really horrible to play against, naturally you start to lose those things. And the goal starts in Southampton's box. The goal that Southampton score starts in their box. The presses doesn't quite work. There's a bit of depth between them, a bit of space to exploit. The ball's played down. I think it goes wide, but then they play through Arsenal's half and they're outnumbered. So they're outnumbered was the problem. They've got the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Southampton players versus Arsenal's 4 at the back when they get into the final third. And then it's really clever movement. Armstrong from left to right. Arsenal structure is good. They're not getting swapped around too much. You sometimes see Gabriel and Saliba, when they're trying to pass off a runner to someone else, they get split a little bit. They maybe get caught in a line when they should be flat. Well, no, you shouldn't be flat, but you should be in a flat line across the pitch, not up the pitch. Yes.
Yeah. Carry on.
And then, yeah. What?
It's a flat line.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Like
should we just talk about Southampton now?
Yeah, I thought it was like a good buzz move on. Yeah.
I don't know how much interest they generate, Southampton. Feel a bit sorry for them. I mean, it's obviously a good point, but most of the time we sort of expect Ralph Hasenhüttl to be sacked. Yeah, they stick by him. They changed all his coaches and they kept with Ralph. They signed lots of really good young players and developed them. Such as Gavin Bazunu, who's in goal. He's only 20. I think they signed him from Manchester City, did they?
They signed a few from Manchester City.
A few, yeah. Maybe that's the secret. Just sign lots of Manchester
City.
Youngsters.
Did they not also sign one of the Manchester City youth development coaches or scouts or something like that as well, who then went somewhere else? Chelsea.
Joe Shields?
Yeah.
Their model is buy young and sell high, right?
So and they stick with their manager and they're still in the Premier League. They're, you know, a role model club for others to follow.
Yeah, I think interesting in terms of the fact that they stuck with Hasenhüttl despite the fact they've clearly wanted to change the way that they're approaching. So they, Hasenhüttl came in as a Red Bull style coach. It was all aggressive, generate chaos, counter press, etc. And this season they've not done that. You mentioned the first line of the press was more blocky than it was like aggressive press, and that's been true a lot this season. I think they're a little bit more of a mid-block team. They're looking to possess the ball rather than to necessarily win back through counter-pressing a lot as well. And it seems to work. And this is a game where, as you say, like he does make some tactical switches and it does improve things. So I think Hasenhüttl is a decent manager. So good on them for keeping him, I suppose.
We also have a result that was a big one for fans of English football in the 70s and 80s. This was exciting. There was loads of nostalgia over this, which not many people watching may care about, but nostalgia all the same, because Nottingham Forest won Lil Liverpool. They look like that. They didn't look themselves. And that's kind of what I'm saying there, obviously, deliberately. Forest changed their formation as well, JJ. Everyone's changed their formation. That's good.
Yeah, this is something I was going to look at later. Like in more detail, because I can give you a very brief thing, and that they've changed from playing a back three or back five, which is what Cooper has always been playing with Nottingham Forest for the last season, to a 4-1-4-1 or 4-2-3-1. And then since they've gone to like a 4-3-3, 4-1-4-1, they've got some points,
hey!
Which is good. And they've also beaten Liverpool. So this is them playing a 4-1-4-1 at home, obviously very decent. But I've not seen the full game, so I don't know enough to tell you.
I mean, I saw a lot of it because it was on in the press room at Bramall Lane. But I don't really know much about it. But, this is classic Steve Cooper result for me. Like, really be, you know, sort of tight and a bit stodgy, good on the counter. Created some good chances, didn't they? Liverpool what are they? They're all over the place. And as someone else pointed out, I mean, they had Carvalho and Harvey Elliott in their midfield. I mean, both were playing in the Championship last season and two seasons ago. Regardless of how good they are, they're not ready to be doing what Liverpool needs yet, are they?
Yeah, Liverpool are a funny one because, you know, they will beat Man City one week and then lose to Nottingham Forest the next. So big questions about why that is the case. I think I'm always going to say they're probably tactical to an extent. When you're a team like Liverpool at the top of the league, teams are going to largely play against you in a certain way, which is sitting deeper against you, and then you've got to figure out how to break down low blocks. And that, I think that's always been the issue that Jurgen Klopp has been trying to sort out. And he's done that by, when he first came in, obviously had a really sort of odd midfield, and everyone was like, how can Liverpool be so good with a midfield with like Jordan Henderson and James Milner in it or whatever, or Adam Lallana? And I feel as though, you know, they've tried to develop that midfield so they've got more on-ball quality on it, in it. But that does come at the expense of some of the more functional stuff that midfield was doing as well. And I suspect, and again, I didn't watch this game, but I suspect that the issue that we're seeing now from Liverpool is to do with the fact that as soon as one part of your system breaks, everything seems to fall apart. So we talk a lot about Trent Alexander-Arnold. We talk a lot about Liverpool's problems in defensive situations, not protecting their back four. And I suspect a lot of that comes from the higher press not working as well as it did. So when you have a higher press, you can protect your defence a lot better. And that comes down to having different players in that front line, having different players in the midfield. Essentially, I think this JJ will agree with me, like there's lots of little things happening all at once, which means that they are now no longer the greater than the sum of their parts.
It just happens sometimes. Like, I mean, you can even look back to Sir Alex Ferguson's Man United team. Sometimes they win the league and then they might have a bit of a drop off and finish fourth or something like that. Like it's totally normal. And they basically came to an end of a cycle, and this is probably the start of a new one now. It will take time for them to then become what they're going to be in the future going forward. They'll change, like the age profile of their team is slightly older than it was. He wants to play a type of football, that suits a younger team. It takes time to get the new players back in together. You want to maintain the older players in there so you keep the values through and you keep standards the same. But then just little things go wrong, like James Milner caught in it. Not James Milner, Alexander-Arnold caught slightly out of position or whatever, or Joe Gomez having a terrible time, Matip not being quite there, injuries in the midfield, Harvey Elliott learning how to play or how to stop opposition counters. He's very good on the ball, maybe not as strong enough there. There's a change of shape to try and deal with structural issues. And I think it's just the end of a cycle, and then they'll start a new one as well. Like players like Sadio Mane leaving is the example of like that's a cycle ended. One of the key players of it gone now.
What should we expect from Liverpool if they're in, you know, a transitional bit? Can they finish in the top four whilst transitioning?
No, they'll definitely, they can definitely finish the top four. I'd expect them to, actually. Like, they're still brilliant. It's just that it's, sometimes these things happen where things go against you like this. It happened to him at Borussia Dortmund where things just kept going against you. The underlying numbers, they're all right. Like, they're fine. They're going to finish probably top four. And they're still decent to watch. You saw earlier that they got absolutely bodied by Napoli in the Champions League a little while ago, just torn apart with individual errors and things not working the way they used to. And now, I didn't think they'd start adjusting things as quickly as they have because it's worked so well for so long. But they see that the way they set up now is like a 4-2-3-1 and 4-4-2. Both Klopp and Pep Linders are obsessed with Arrigo Sacchi. Like, they absolutely love him. And I think Klopp's written theses on him for his coaching badge or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong with that, but they definitely talk about him a lot. I know he studied videos of him and Roy Hodgson. That's who Klopp studied when he was doing his UEFA Pro, I think.
Good knowledge.
Yeah. And Sacchi was always like a 4-4-2, kind of like really high press, aggressive kind of play. It'll just come together. I think it'll be absolutely fine.
Excellent.
But, yeah.
That's the news. Also, Jürgen's press conferences and questions are good fun. He's entertaining. He's, you know, he's giving a lot when asked. It's good.
Like, doesn't suffer fools lightly, does he?
He doesn't. Yeah. Much like me. Not in any way like me. Nice segue into Napoli, though, because now we're going to touch on some Serie A, which, as I informed earlier in the pod, is Italian. Roma 0-1 Napoli. Now, this, you know, they could have been 1 point between the two sides towards the top of Serie A had Roma won. They didn't. Jose Mourinho's team lost to Napoli, who are awesome. I love them, especially Javica Kvaratskhelia.
They're one of the most fun teams to watch.
Oh, thanks.
Just now, Napoli.
They are, aren't they? They're so much fun, which I said last time I was on this podcast. I just haven't moved on. Sorry. Yeah. Let's talk about how fun they are, shall we? Apparently Rangers are playing Napoli in midweek. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, shouldn't laugh.
Wednesday game, that's going to be very difficult for them. They're not playing very well either just now, and Gio van Bronckhorst's in a bit of trouble. But on Napoli, they're absolutely brilliant. Luciano Spalletti is the manager. Really, really influential in Italian football. He's managed a lot of teams. He managed Roma twice, I think, didn't he?
He certainly managed them once.
Oh, I think it was maybe a twice. I don't know. Yeah, I can't remember.
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, he was the one that got rid of Francesco Totti, so they don't like him there. That is one thing. But he plays really nice football. And with Napoli, what I like about them is I think it's to do with controlling the tempo of games. Like, they don't always go full at it all the time. They sort of lull you in and then go, 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 and then bring it in. It's like taking advantage of exact moments of when to exploit bits of space you've taken in. And they were patient in this game. And it wasn't until about 75 minutes when Mourinho, having seen out the first 75, allows his team to push up a little bit more. That's when they finally got the goal, which is an absolute pinger, by the way.
What a finish.
Yeah. But yeah, I've enjoyed watching them heaps.
It was good fun. Yes. I don't know if I've got anything else. Anything else to say?
Yeah, I found this an interesting game. Roma, weirdly under Jose Mourinho, have got really good numbers in the last couple of seasons, which is not what we necessarily associate with Jose Mourinho. So I expected this to be a quite close game, and I thought Roma did a good job of keeping Napoli quiet because, as JJ said, like, Napoli have just destroyed teams this season. And yeah, I just found it a pretty fun game on the back of that.
Doubling up on that, Kvaratskhelia on the... So like, this boy, what's his first name?
Kvaratskhelia.
Kvaratskhelia is a Georgian winger. He's right-footed, but he plays on the left wing. He's absolutely brilliant. But he does things... He's got that thing that really good players have where they play against the flow of time. Now, bear with me with what I mean this, but like, what you normally have is someone will take a couple of steps and then that's the natural point where you would execute a pass or you would then start your dribble or something like that, almost like it's an animation in a video game. But he plays outside of that. So he does little things that you know he's going to do them, but he does them just a tiny split second before. So like, someone will close him down and he puts the ball through their legs or just other side of them and then skips past. Like, he always knew that he was in control of the situation, even though he shouldn't be. And there's things he's doing where his decision making isn't always perfect. He'll take someone on the outside when he never should. But he's a player that he would suit, like, I could see him being at Man City or something in the future. It'd be perfect for the way that Guardiola wants a winger 1v1 against the player in that wide areas. And he's one of the reasons that Napoli are so good this season. And he's scored more goals than the other player in the team. Key for assists, he takes their penalties now as well. But they've got some great players in there. Zielinski's a great player. Really fun to watch. Central midfielder, well, he's an attacking midfielder. And I think Spalletti's shape, it changes from being a 4-3-3 to 4-2-3-1 at times. They press in different ways. Zambo Anguissa, who was useless at Fulham. I mean, I've just been saying that to exaggerate, but he was not very good at Fulham. Absolutely brilliant for them. He was missing for the Roma games, got injured. But then they bring another player to cover for him. I think they bring in Tongi Ndombele, who's the same exact player as he was at Spurs. Gives the ball away, tries something fancy, gives the ball away. But decent when he's allowed to do things that he's good at, he's really fun to watch. You can see why he's such a highly valued player, but kind of unreliable at that level. But I would honestly put them, I think whoever gets them in Champions League knockouts would be really worried because they could beat most teams in the competition.
Luciano Spalletti, he pioneered playing Totti as a false nine before binning him off. He was at Roma between 2005 and 2009 and 2016-17. Well done. He's also managed Empoli twice, Sampdoria twice, Venezia twice, Udinese twice, recurring theme here, Zenit St. Petersburg once, and Internazionale once. That's a lot. And there are others, I'm reliably informed. I thought, without knowing anything about Spalletti, that he was kind of more sort of successful trophy-wise and things than he was.
He did won the Russian Premier League, let's not forget that.
Well, there you go.
There's a few Coppa Italias and Super Coppa Italianas in there as well.
Done.
Just looking at the lineups now, yeah, you talked about Quaricelli, obviously the real danger man for Napoli, but the way that Roma doubled up on him, so they basically went with a back three, went with a 3-5-2, and then had Karsdorp, who was the right wing back, and Mancini, who's the right centre back. They doubled up on him, and I expected Napoli to maybe make more problems because of that, because obviously when you are going to double up on a player like that, it does open up spaces for you to attack. And you've mentioned Zielinski, who's just a very sort of, he has very good movement for a centre midfielder. And so, as you said, on paper, it looks like a midfield three, but Zielinski can push forward and join that forward line.
It's a good mix. Lobotka sits in as a little six, like a Jorginho-type player. And then the eight next to him tends to be Anguissa, who pushes up and they press really high up the pitch. And then they drop deep. So they vary from game to game, and they vary within games as well.
Yeah,
very hard to predict what they're going to do. You can sort of know what some of the players are going to do, but then they change it up, and they've got interchangeable players like Politano can play wide right. Chucky Lozano started in this game, a decent player. They're quite good. In fact, if you play as them on like FIFA, they're quite highly rated players. Yes. It's a good team.
That's it. Where you can.
I played with them to research them.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you manipulate them all in the right way?
No, I just used whatever the Spalletti tactics they put in the game are. But I know a lot of commentators use video games to do their research and teams. That helps. It's really good.
Going wrong.
Spalletti had this famous quote about how you don't have systems so much anymore. Like automated systems in football don't work as well. So you have to have players who are better able to interpret space as and when it appears. So I thought because of that, the fact that there was that doubling up on Kvaratskhelia, there would be more exploitation of space. But I felt as though Roma were sort of like then biased towards that side where Kvaratskhelia was on. It generated space on the other side, which I didn't think Tanguy Ndombele was able to exploit in quite the same way. But this game could easily have ended 0-0. I think everyone is rightly praising Osimhen's goal, but I thought that Smalling was poor in keeping him away from the goal, and Patricio should probably have done better trying to stop it. So this game could easily have ended 0-0.
4,000 miles an hour towards.
Yeah, I mean, it was both of these things. There was a percentage chance that it would happen, but I thought between
that's
the two,
generally
of them,
how it works.
But yeah, it could have ended 0-0, and I think it would have been testament to Mourinho's ability to stop a team like Napoli, who are very exciting at the moment.
All that praise Jose could have won. Go watch Napoli; they're fun. They are on 29 points at the top of Serie A after 11 games. That's 3 points ahead of AC Milan in second. Lazio are third, level on 24 points with Atalanta. Shall I keep going? Roma are fifth on 22 points. Then it's Udinese in sixth on 21, as are Inter Milan, well, that's not very good, who are also on 21 points. And then Juventus at eighth. That's not very good.
Juventus are bad this season.
They are bad. But maybe they'll be good soon again. So watch out for that. That's Italy. Nicely rounded up. In that case, with that done, all that I did want to say was mention that Tifo Talks There's another podcast on its way. I think you can get these on the audio feed. So if you're listening to this on audio feed, subscribe to those audio feeds and then the podcast will just miraculously appear, which is obviously underplaying the terribly hard work everyone's gone to. John, what's next on TIFO Talks?
Yeah, so we've just had a number of podcast episodes out. So we had Jonathan Wilson to open things off. We've had an episode with James Montague talking about the World Cup, Justin Kraft talking about Bayern Munich, Jesse Parker-Humphreys talking about tactics in the women's game. I'm actually not on the episode this week. So if you want to find out more about that, you're going to have to go to JJ, who was on it.
Well, that's fortunate. Yeah.
Well, we got to talk. So me, Joe and Seb got to talk to Humphrey Carr, who is the very tall, lovely, funny English lad from the Welcome to Wrexham documentary. So he works closely with Rob McElhenney on Mythic Quest, that thing. So, you know, very excited to talk to this guy because I always wanted to be a comedy writer. That's what I wanted to do. Here I am.
Wow.
Was that a dream job?
Right?
I've won, everyone.
Why didn't that work out?
Oh, because I got into football. I just combined the two. It's just like I had to do comedy stuff.
I just had Joe's voice in my head at that point. Humphrey
is a writer and actor in his own right. But he also became the executive director or something like that at Wrexham. I can't remember exactly his title, but really important with the guy who has never had any experience doing that. Basically, the eyes and ears of Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney at Wrexham. And he's really nice. The interview's very fun to listen to. So.
Wow. Well, listen to it then.
On Thursday.
Make sure you subscribe. Oh, yes, John.
That will also be on the TIFO IRL channel as well.
Yes.
We filmed it.
Oh, excellent.
But not all of the TIFO Talks podcasts will be on the IRL channel. Which so you do need to sign up.
Subscribe. Right, we're done, aren't we? I have no idea when we started, so we literally could have been in here for 4 hours, as far as I know. But hopefully it won't be that long when it goes live. Thank you to the guests. They were JJ Bull.
Yes.
And John McKenzie.
Also,
The lovely John McKenzie. thanks to Seb Stafford-Bloor. Hopefully he's still not waiting for us in Germany. Hopefully his gates are okay. Thanks to producer Steve for giving me stuff to say. That's very important. Thank you to producer Jamie, who's over there. I've no idea if you can see him on video. Probably not. He is here, honestly. Joe will be back next week, I assume, unless he's still in Germany. Is he in Germany? We don't know. Bye!